IB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The U.S. military says one of its bases in northeast Syria has come under a rocket attack. North Korea fires two more ballistic missiles, its seventh such launch in 2 weeks, and that in response to drills by the South and the U.S. And people take to the streets across several European cities to protest soaring energy and food prices. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Welcome. The U.S. military says that a rocket attack has hit one of its bases in northeast Syria. The Central Command says the attack on the Rumaylin landing zone caused no injuries or damage. According to CENTCOM, the military has found the launch site, but it's not clear who fired the rockets. The U.S. keeps several outposts in Syria, mainly in the country's oil-rich east. Washington claims that the military presence is aimed at preventing a resurgence of Daesh terrorists. But Syria sees the deployments illegal and a pretext to steal its oil. An Israeli soldier has been killed following an overnight operation by Palestinians in East Jerusalem al-Quds. According to the Israeli military, the soldier died of wounds he sustained in a shooting incident at a checkpoint near a refugee camp. Two other troops were also injured in the attack. Islamic Jihad movement has hailed the operation, calling it a proper response to the regime's atrocities. Tensions have run high over the past months across the occupied Palestinian territories. On Saturday, people held mass funerals in the occupied West Bank for three teenagers who were recently killed by Israeli forces. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed so far this year, making it the deadliest year since 2015. Human rights activist Firas al-Najm says that the recent developments in Palestine show that the Palestinian resistance and revolution is growing and is being led by the youth.
Why is the Palestinian people not treated like real humans? Why are they treated like terrorists when they rise up and fight? But this also gives us a good sign that the ignition from Jenin, especially this area, Jenin, is actually shows that the revolution is growing, the resistance is growing, and the youth are dying. So that means the youth is the real generation that has the most energy and has the most capacity to fight back and resist. And today we see that a lot of youth are dying because they're resisting, because they're standing up, because they're shouting out Free Palestine. They're fighting for the blood of the martyrs that were their friends and cousins and brothers and associates and so on, students that were with them. So this is a very good sign, I think, at the same time that the Palestinians are not giving up. And the Zionists think that by killing more, by suppressing more, by installing fear more, that the Palestinians are going to retract and they're going to become submissive. And this is exactly not the equation that's happening. The Palestinians today are getting stronger and stronger. It's going to become more dangerous for the Israelis because it should be this way.
The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine has held a protest in solidarity with prisoners on hunger strike in Israeli jails. People from all walks of life came out to support the prisoners, and that's because the Palestinian prisoners see no end in sight to their suffering, as hundreds of them are being held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention policy. Ashraf Shannon reports from Gaza.
People have taken to the streets of Gaza to voice support for Palestinian prisoners on hunger strike in Israeli jails. 30 prisoners have been on hunger strike for 2 weeks to protest their administrative detention. The protest was organized by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers where they are, denied basic human rights. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and expressed their unwavering support for the prisoners.
Administrative detention is brutal and inhumane. We came out today to support all Palestinian prisoners, especially administrative detainees on hunger strike. Palestinian prisoners are freedom fighters, and we will use all forms of resistance to help secure their release.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinians are languishing inside Israeli jails, including minors and women. Palestinian prisoners frequently stage hunger strikes in protest against both the administrative detention policy and harsh prison conditions.
I'm wearing a prison uniform to remind the whole world of the suffering of Palestinian prisoners, especially those on hunger strike. Hunger strikers are fighting for a just cause, and we will always support them.
The Israeli regime violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention. Palestinians are calling on the international community to come out of its silence on Palestinian prisoners.
We are calling for the release of all Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. We are also calling on all the free people of the world to support Palestinian prisoners.
Statistics show that Israeli forces have arrested more than 1 million Palestinians since 1967.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime is holding more than 700 Palestinians behind bars without charge or trial. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Time now for the news review. The situation remains highly volatile on the Korean Peninsula, with North Korea firing two more ballistic missiles as part of its recent barrage of weapons tests. South Korean military says that the short-range missiles were fired toward the East Sea. It called the launches a serious provocation. Japan has also confirmed the launches, saying the missiles landed outside its exclusive economic zone. Seoul, Tokyo, and Washington have ramped up combined exercises in recent weeks, from formation flights and bombing drills to firing missiles. Now joining me are a couple of guests, our own correspondent Frank Smith in Seoul, and also Andrew Leung, he's an independent China specialist, is joining me from Hong Kong. Now, Frank brings an update on the latest situation on the Korean Peninsula, both from the North and South Korea's perspective.
Well, South Korea convened a National Security Council meeting today to discuss the launch and to sort of rally forces to monitor North Korean behavior. This launch of two missiles took place at about 2 a.m. They flew about 350 kilometers, so they were shorter range than the previous tests that have taken place. Again, this follows the drills of the South Korean and U.S. militaries, including the USS Ronald Reagan, a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, which also conducted a drill with South Korea and Japan on Thursday, and previously conducted large-scale exercises with South Korea for the first time in 5 years about 2 weeks ago. That is really sort of what some analysts believe triggered this latest round of testing on the part of North Korea, although other analysts will suggest this is just part of North Korea's missile development, what they say as defensive measures. This also comes just on the eve of North Korea's 77th anniversary of the North Korean Workers' Party, and events like that have been occasions on which North Korea has conducted other types of missile launches before.
Mm-hmm. All right, Andrew, this is the seventh missile launch in 2 weeks, and then it comes right on the heels of joint drills by the U.S., Japan, South Korea. And each side considers what the other side does, whether it's a missile test or drills, they call that provocation. Who's provoking who? I mean, how do you look at this? What's your assessment? Is this some kind of muscle flexing? Is it a show? Is it a real escalation? What do you see on the horizon?
Well, I think that we have got to look at the issue in the proper context. This is nothing new.
because it comes as it has after decades of so-called six-party talks between North Korea and other countries, including the United States and China and South Korea, but has ended up with nothing, because all these talks have been premised on the necessity that North Korea gives up everything, its insurance policy against coercion that threatens its own perceived national security. So more talks are not going to deliver the goods as far as North Korea is concerned. Now, let's face it, North Korea is a very, very small country, and it does not harbor any territorial expansion, let alone starting a regional war. What it wants is to defend its own national security. But at the end of the day, it's all rhetoric. It's lost patience. It's developing its own capability, nuclear capability, as a insurance policy, as a last resort, not to start a regional war, because it would be stupid. Why should it? So at the end of the day, I think that both the West and, to a certain extent, South Korea need to come to terms with the reality of the situation. More and more weapons, more kind of military exercises, threatening North Korea fire and fury, as in the case of Donald Trump, you know, doesn't work. So, and then even more negotiations, because we've got decades of six-party talks insisting that North Korea should give up everything right from day one. So I think this mentality needs to be readjusted before convincing talks. And naturally, no countries want to have to see a nuclear-armed North Korea, including China, because it's going to destabilize the region. But then, on the other hand, it's not jaw-jaw, of course, better than war, but it's a what kind of jaw-jaw, you know, how to talk, how to give North Koreans a sense of security, a sense of national development, how to help its people. That in fact is the Holy Grail.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Frank Smith in Seoul, Andrew Ling in Hong Kong. People have rallied across several European cities to protest against soaring energy and food prices. In the Czech Republic, thousands gathered in the capital Prague to protest what demonstrators called the government's inaction in addressing the soaring inflation. They demanded higher wages to be able to afford the rising prices. In the German capital Berlin, a similar protest was organized by far-right groups. Ralliers held banners and chanted anti-government slogans that rejected the government's policies in dealing with prices. Energy prices have soared in Europe recently, especially after Russia cut off its gas supplies to a number of European countries. Jerome Hughes sheds more light on the protest rallies against soaring prices. Let's take a listen.
People are becoming more and more frustrated. Obviously, that's being fueled by the fact that we have cost of living crisis, rising inflation, rising interest rates, and people just feel that they are not being looked after by their political leaders. There's also a feeling that there's a lack of information. I mean, we keep hearing about the billions of euro that's being coming from the European Commission, the EU, you could say, the executive arm, to prop up the Ukrainian government and also to arm the Ukrainian military. That's coming from the EU. We do get some firm figures in relation to that. But then individual countries are providing huge amounts of weapons, hardware, and providing individual cash sums as well to Ukraine. So the overall picture is very, very cloudy indeed. And also, we have a lack of information about the energy costs. I mean, we keep hearing and being told that the energy prices are going up and up, and yet then we get bits and pieces in the media about we're getting energy supplies from different parts of the world. Again, there's a certain amount of coordination from the European Commission in terms of buying energy, but then individual countries are going ahead and doing deals with countries. And again, the overall picture in relation to that is very shady as well. So people feel that they're not getting enough information. And also, you will hear commentators saying that people more and more feel let down by the mainstream media in the West.
Thousands of supporters of WikiLeaks' founder have formed a human chain outside the British Parliament, demanding the government cancel plans to extradite Julian Assange to the U.S. He could face charges that could see him jailed for life there. The U.S. is trying to prosecute Assange for revealing American crimes in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Said Purza has a report from London.
Linked hand in hand, thousands of men and women surround the British Houses of Parliament, a symbolic act in solidarity with a man they call the world's foremost political prisoner.
It's obvious for any observer, for anyone who is fairly looking at this situation, that this is an enormous, monumental injustice of a man who is being persecuted by the authorities who are using the coercive powers of the state in order to try to punish him for doing the right thing.
That right thing was exposing American crimes and conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, for which he is wanted by the U.S. government. The now 51-year-old Australian, co-founder of whistleblower website WikiLeaks, has been locked up in a maximum security prison near London since April 2019.
To his many supporters, Julian Assange is an anti-establishment hero who's been victimized, and that his prosecution is a politically motivated assault on journalism and on free speech.
Organized by the Don't Extradite Julian Assange campaign, the human chain is not just about securing one man's freedom.
This has implications for pretty much every journalist who publishes material critical of the United States. If he is actually extradited and they succeed, then any other journalist in the UK or from around the world could face the same fate as Julian Assange, which would, of course, would be a strong discouragement to them to publish any critical material, and we get something like a chilling effect, basically, whereby the press ceases to scrutinize foreign policy of the most powerful nation on the planet.
And that powerful nation, under the Trump administration, it was revealed last year, plotted to kidnap or kill Assange as he sheltered in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Saeed Purza, London.
All right, and that brings it into this broadcast from Tehran. Thank you for being with us.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
future.
Welcome back to Aperture. We looked into the life of Muhammad Iqbal from his birthplace in Punjab province of British India, now in Pakistan, to his academic studies in the University of Cambridge. Iqbal was a very learned man who was known for his political ideologies and philosophical theories. He is fondly remembered as a great poet and scholar. The political content of Muhammad Iqbal's poetry is one of the most fascinating aspects of his work. Except for a few poems, his entire poetic endeavor is tinged with the political concerns of his time. Both domestic and international political events shaped his poetry. He not only responded to political events in his verse, but also inspired his fellow Indian Muslims through his poetry to find a way out of the political dilemma in which the British colonial rule had put them. Stay with us as we looked into how Iqbal helped his fellow Indian Muslims aspire to a better future and guided them on the road to freedom.
Iqbal's message is addressed only to the youth. He calls them Royal Falcons. As held by Iqbal, the Royal Falcon has five characteristics. Iqbal wants the youth to catch hold of Falcon's characteristics as much as possible. The five good attributes of the Royal Falcon, as seen by Iqbal, are flying high. So Iqbal wants the youth to fly high for sure. The second attribute is keen eyesight. The youth can fly high only if they have keen eyesight. Its third attribute is that it does not build a nest, nor does it follow richness. The fourth attribute, it loves solitude, as it is a source of creativity. The last attribute, as told by Iqbal of the Royal Falcon, is it does not eat the prey hunted by others. Iqbal wants the youth to show these five attributes. Allama's poetry consists of certain periods. His poetry was at first as the poetry of the day. He would say at that time, "My Urdu poems are like a building made of clay." Little by little, his Persian poems came into existence. Among the first Persian poems were the familiar secrets and the mysteries of rapture. Such poems end with Javed Name, or perhaps with "What can be done, O Eastern people?"
Gradually, Iqbal changes from a national poet to the poet of the Islamic world. His versified story, "The Familiar Secrets and the Mysteries of Rapture," is first translated into English by Reynold Nicholson and published in the region. Years later, his Javedname is translated into German and Turkish in 1957 by those who study Islam, including Anna Marie Schimmel. The book is published in Munich, Hermann Hesse. The German writer and a winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature writes an introduction to Javedname, as requested by the translator. Hesse writes, "Sir Muhammad Iqbal belongs to three intellectual domains. His works are the outcome of these three intellectual domains: Indian intellectual domain, spiritual domain, and Western thought's domain."
There are three groups of Persian poets. The first, those who are absolutely meaning-oriented.
Iqbal, as a poet, is highly accomplished. He has bridged the gap between wisdom and heart.
The second, those who are pedantic. Meaning is absent in their poems. They pay attention to words and nothing more.
His poems touch the reader's sensations because they are so meaningful and precede even the thoughts forming in their minds.
The third, those whose poems are full of both words and meanings. From among them, we can name Hafez and Saadi.
Such senses calm mind, imagination, and consequently heart. This is a rare attribute seen in such great poets as Hafez and Rumi. The attribute is common in all Iqbal's poems.
Allama Iqbal has mastery not only over words, but also over various meanings, meanings which come out of him and are derived from his thoughts. His meaning-oriented poems outnumber his other types of poems, just as Rumi's. Iqbal says, "There is no comparison between the melody and me. Speaking is only a pretext. I am pulling the camel, which has no rein."
Allama Iqbal, with a faith in Islam and a reasonable Gnostic faith indicating his deep certitude in God's sovereignty, moves his mind to search for secrets and mysteries of the creation. In his Islamic Gnostic poems, and such verified stories as the souvenir of Hijaz, the Eastern message, the familiar secrets, and the mysteries of rapture, he talks about the principles of internal ontology of things and idealization of the existential world. While his thoughts are at the height of their powers, he invites Muslims to solidify familiar philosophy exactly in accordance to monotheism, to bring about a new perspective, a new world view into the Islamic world.
So many memories are related to this house. My father came to live in this house when he was 11. Now, what sort of memory do you want me to tell you? Talking about Iqbal's thoughts reminds us of the familiar thoughts as his central train of thought. We hear Iqbal saying, "To a mullah, a denier of God is an unbeliever. To me, more unbeliever is he who denies his own self."
Just ask, what is Iqbal's philosophy? The answer is, the philosophy of your own. Iqbal's philosophy is in fact the philosophy of one's own, or familiar philosophy. What is familiar philosophy? That you know your origin very well.
Never in my life have I been interested in the world's wealth or posts. I built this very house just to accept my wife's repeated requests. My wife's fate in this house had a different form. Here became a safe place for those in search of their identity. I clearly saw that most Muslims in the motherland had lost their Islamic identity, and to regain it, they need to struggle hard. The house, quiet corner, became a place for those who wish to fly faults of self-belief, something much needed by all.
The house originally belonged to my father, Javed Iqbal. The house title deed had already been issued to my grandmother. Upon the death of my grandmother, the deed was transferred to my father. Allama Iqbal would live here as my father's tenant. He paid the rent to my father every month or every 3 months.
Never did I lose my interest in my native lands, people, My best time was when I was among people to see them struggle hard to earn their living. I was inspired by their uproar in the Anarkly district. Loftier than the heavens is the station of man, and the beginning of education is respect for man.
Iqbal lays heavy emphasis on the familiar secrets and mysteries of rapture. Familiarity, as seen by Gnostics, means to entertain the self, to fully know the self. It's a famous statement that knowing the self is meant knowing God. Iqbal emphasized, first and foremost, returning to the self. Search within yourself in order to know the self.
Iqbal invites us to know ourselves before doing anything else. Anything else. We shall hide in ourselves to become a human being, Paul excellence.
From God's own being, the self got a being so. From God's own show, to self he gave a show. About this shining pearl, I know not where. It could be then without a river there.
Iqbal meant to look carefully at human beings on the one hand and to look carefully at Islamic ideology on the other hand. For that very reason, we see Iqbal describing in detail the Eastern society and the essence of Islamic thought.
Who is a selected man? A selected man is the one who is searched for by God. He is in a form desired by God. God wants that kind of human being. This is possible only if man searches for himself, to train himself in a desirable way, to maintain the self, to try hard to fully understand the self. This way finally leads to knowing well the Supreme Being.
The greatest message of Iqbal, as expressed in his poems, is to know yourself, to turn to your own self, to know the East, not the West.
Signs of going senile can be seen very easily in me. The tick-tock of the clock shows clearly the passage of my life. So quickly pass opportunities. So little time have I to reach the end of the line. Oh, the memory of those days when time's sword was allied with the strength of our hands and unveiled the face of truth. Our nails tore loose the knot of this world. Our bowing in prayer gave blessings to the earth. From the jar of truth we made rosy wine gush forth. We charged against the ancient taverns.
इस घर की तामीर हमारी दादी की ख्वाहिश पे की गई थी पर वो इस घर में
सिर्फ This house was built under my grandmother's wish.
उनकी यहां पे बीमार
But only for 2 or 3 days she lived here.
चौथे दिन वो वफात पा गई.
She was sick when they carried her in a car, but she survived only for 2 or 3 days. At the age of 11, my father lost his mother when my aunt was about 6 years old. My father and my aunt would come here every day to see Allama, who was lying on this bed. Allama called them and my aunt would come up to Allama and my father would sit on the other side of the bed. This way Allama would feel comfortable.
इस तरह वालिद लेट जाते थे
मैं उनके चली जाती थी शाम के वक्त शाम होनी तो स्कूल से आके
I usually went to see them after school. Allama was always lying on his bed and resting.
मैं पास जाके लेट जाती थी तो वहीं पे सारे मेहमान
I was always beside him.
हर वक्त लोगों
Other people would also go there.
मिलना मिलाना मुसलसली जारी रहता था
इस घर में कई लोग अलामा को मिलने आ चुके हैं कायदे आजम मोहम्मद अली जिन्ना
Many came here to see him among them General Muhammad Ali Jinnah Jawaharlal Nehru Muhammad Ali Jauhar and many other intimate friends of Allama
Allama sahab अपने बिस्तर पे बैठते थे और
They would come here just before or after midday to have a chat with Allama about topics like poetry philosophy or any other things. Allama spent his last days of life here.
I was well aware that the main reason why India went under the yoke of British colonization was lack of knowledge of self and reliance on others. Self-awareness springs out self-dependence and internal richness. Know yourself, know your hidden parts, nurture your parts, and create a new world, which will compensate for old shortcomings and soul defects, to pave the way for comprehensive development. It is the self which originates existence. It is self-awareness which gives birth to human values. It is the self which affects existence. What human beings see or intuit is a manifestation of the self through mysteries. The form of existence is an effect of the self. Whatsoever thou seest is a secret of the self.
Iqbal's philosophy is objective and tangible. He pulls down philosophy from the metaphysical world to make it tangible and applicable to common people. Iqbal's philosophy is therefore a practical philosophy. It can be put into practice.
O Muslims, you have to preserve your own self. You must follow God and His book, the Holy Quran. When you achieve success in making your own self, you can resist even the whole world. No one can harm you. What is the basis of survival? Survival is based on making your own self. It is the self, the nature mentioned by Quran. And this is the essence of Iqbal's thoughts. This is what Iqbal means of the concept of self. For that very reason, every member of the Islamic world should know this way of thinking, personally and socially.
Today we see a group of ignorant people who commit, under the name of Islam, the most heinous acts, though they are all against Islamic teachings. In fact, they are all Satan's companions and toys in the hands of those who want to mislead them. About these people, Iqbal says, Europe very well knows how to secure interests, while granting to this takes a loan of that. It gives sustenance to Satan in a way that leaves perplexed even God.
Nowadays, there are calculated plots against Islam. The enemy is very active to destroy the Islamic world from within. I personally think that we need Iqbal's ideas about Islam now more than ever before. You are simultaneously a learned man, a Sayyid, a descendant of the Prophet. But tell me, are you a Muslim too?
A Muslim is called infidel by another Muslim. It is not a non-Muslim who calls him infidel. It is a Muslim. All problems are created and spread here and there by those who are pursuing only their own interests.
The phrase which brings unity to you all is, there is no God but Allah. As Iqbal says, the key to our unity, salvation, and survival, and a sign of familiarity, is in this phrase, there is no God but Allah. Those who follow this phrase never behead Muslims. Iqbal's basic philosophy is that all of us should be unified. All of us should form one single family. Muslims should get unified to guard the sanctuary. I mean Muslims from the Nile shores to the city of Kashgar.
Iqbal tells us to put aside personal interests and to move into a direction leading to social interests. Put aside your personal interests. Let's talk about our religion, our unity. We will end in success. Just because of his thoughts, Iqbal is living on today. I think so.
Just have a look at the tragic events caused by a group of people who are Muslims in name only, as if there has never been a person like Iqbal. His philosophy has sunk into oblivion, as if Iqbal never lived among us. This is a great sorrow, casting a shadow over all Iqbal's philosophy and thoughts. There is no memory of him anymore. The light of all his great books has gone out. The Everlasting Letter, The Familiar Secrets, The Secrets of Rapture, The Persian Psalms, What Can Be Done, O People of the East, The Route of Philosophy in Iran, The Eastern Message, and Reconstructing Islamic Religious Thoughts. During his last days, Allama says, as Iran, full of unknown meaning, I am unable to endure censurers' sayings. Neither have I any option, nor am I coerced. I am but a living soil, always in revolution.
Isi tarah jab aakhri raat thi Allama sahab ki, to wo dono bache isi darwaze pe aaye.
Then came the last night of Allama's life. His two children came to have their last look at him. Allama was still conscious. Someone from Germany had come to see him, a friend of his or his teacher. The German called the two children and hugged them. My father was leaving the room, but my aunt wasn't. She wanted to stay with him for a while.
At the time, I felt I had to stay with Allama and to sit there motionlessly. Our tutor, Aunt Doris, came there to take me with her. I told her, I will stay here at least for a while.
Allama told the tutor,
she knows that this is the last meeting between the father and the daughter. That is why she doesn't want to leave. Let her stay.
She knows this is the last time she sees her father.
And finally, I felt something was going to happen. For that very reason, I didn't want to leave the place.
Early in the morning, Allama passed away. The muezzin was calling out the morning adhan. Here, beside this bed, was standing his close friend, Ali Bakhsh. There were some other friends too, although most of them were saying their morning prayers at the mosque at that time. Back then, the mosque was more like a house than anything else. Friends were there to say their prayers in congregation. After their prayers, Allama passed away. His last words were the two testimonies. Then his soul flew to the sky. I personally suppose people like Allama will come to this world several centuries later.
Allama Iqbal Lahori died at the age of 61 on April 21, 1938, after a life of diligence and hard work. In the last moments of his life, he put his hand on his chest, telling Ali Bakhsh, his man, I have a pain here. And upon uttering this ambiguous, meaningful remark, he bade farewell to the world. Many attended his funeral and accompanied him to his final resting place next to Masjid-e-Shah in Lahore. On his deathbed, Allama composed this song. Does a song gone come back again? No, no, no. Does a breeze come from Hijaz? No, no, no. There finally came to an end all those days of poverty. Does a Gnostic come back a second time? No, no, no. Allama's thoughts and philosophy will remain with us forever, only if we follow him.
Iqbal was a significant voice in the traumatic history of colonized India. His sensitivity to the plight of his people was sharpened both by his understanding of his roots and his adaptability to the demands of the new colonized world. Politics and philosophy were combined in Iqbal's poetry. Perhaps today, Iqbal's anti-colonial stance can be referred to as neocolonialism is still plaguing the world. And that's it for this week's program. Until next week and another Aperture, it's goodbye.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Salaamu Alaikum. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. On the continuation of this program, Lantern from IRIB English Radio, we'll listen to an interesting story entitled The Fox Without a Tail. A fox that had been caught in a trap succeeded at last after much painful tugging in getting away, but he had to leave his beautiful bushy tail behind him. For a long time, he kept away from the other foxes, for he knew well enough that they would all make fun of him and crack jokes and laugh behind his back. But it was hard for him to live alone, and at last he thought of a plan that would perhaps help him out of his trouble. He called a meeting of all the foxes, saying that he had something of great importance to tell the tribe. When they were all gathered together, the fox without a tail got up and made a long speech about those foxes who had come to harm because of their tails. This one had been caught by hounds when his tail had become entangled in the hedge. The one had not been able to run fast enough because of the weight of his brush. Besides, it was well known, he said, that men hunt foxes simply for their tails, which they cut off as prizes of the hunt. With such proof of the danger and uselessness of having a tail, said Master Fox, he would advise every fox to cut it off if he valued life and safety. When he had finished talking, an old fox arose and said, smiling, Master Fox, kindly turn around for a moment, and you shall have your answer. When the poor fox without a tail turned around, there arose such a storm of jeers and hooting that he saw how useless it was to try any longer to pursue the foxes to part with their tails. Do not listen to the advice of him who seeks to lower you to his own level.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum and welcome to Lantern. We are going to talk about the benefits of accepting advices and advising others. Imam Jawad alayhi salam says that there are three features of a mu'min. The Holy Imam enumerates the features of a believer, and the third of which is his acceptability towards the advices. A mu'min usually accepts the advices. And in order to, while accepting the advices, actually it helps the mu'min, the believer, to be more mature and to actually to perfect his affairs. So we see that, as the Imam Salamu Alaihi said, that one of the features of a believer is to be
is to be accepting the advices. Even from the seventh Imam, it has been narrated that a person usually needs to be with a group of believers and companions who, out of goodness, give him his shortcomings, and criticize him. So, from this beautiful saying of seventh Imam, we understand that first, it's good to, in case we know any problem, any issue, from a brother, a mu'min, or a believer. If we know any fault from any brother or from any sister in faith, it's our duty to mention and to tell him or her in secret. But it brings a sort of, duty to us. And from the other hand, acceptability. It's our duty to accept and to be with those who tell us about our problems and faults and shortcomings. When a person actually accepts the advices of others, it's as if he's consulting with them and he's receiving their consultation. So, and as I said earlier, it leads to maturity and wisdom of that person. And from the other hand, it reduces the morale of arrogance inside the hearts of the believers. So we see that accepting the advices has some benefits. It reaches us to maturity and wisdom, and it makes us even more qualified in the decision or in the issue that we are involved in. And from the other hand, actually, it reduces the morale of arrogance inside our hearts. The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Again, in another hadith, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that Rahimallah abdan sama'a. Imam alayhi salam says, may God have mercy on the one who, when he hears a wise word, learns it well, and when she is guided or when he is guided, he or she accepts it and puts hand on the lamp of the guide and leader, and at that time, this is the time that he is saved. So this is what Imam alayhi salam says with regard to and accepting and admitting a wise word from a guide. Inshallah, we shall finalize this discussion on this show with one more saying from Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he said that if a person advises you, and if a person gives you an advice, do listen and do accept it, and do keep it in your minds. So, as I said, accepting the advices of others will end to the maturity of a person, and from the other side, hopefully, inshallah, it shall reduce the arrogance of a person, or the arrogance morale of people from their hearts. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala put us among those and include us among those who accepts advices, and advices based on the prerequisites and conditions of advice, in case we have the qualifications of advising others, to advise them as a duty, as something which is on our shoulders. But in case we don't have the qualifications of advising others, it's much more better to just receive advices from the wise. Till our next session, I'll leave you in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. أنا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.